Repeat after me. Om Vasudevendra Yogindram. Vasudevendra Yogindram. Natva Jnana Pradangurum. Natva Jnana Pradangurum. Mumukshunam Hitarthaya. Mumukshunam Hitarthaya. Tattvabodho Bhidhiyate. Tattvabodho Bhidhiyate. Sukshma Shariram Kyam. Sukshma Shariram Kyam. Apanchikrita. Apanchikrita. Panchamahabhutaihi. Panchamahabhutaihi. Kritam Sat. Kritam Sat. Karma Janyam. Karma Janyam. Sukadukkhadibhoga Sadhanam. Sukadukkhadibhoga Sadhanam. Panchajnanendriyani. Panchajnanendriyani. Panchakarmendriyani. Panchakarmendriyani. Panchapranadayaha. Panchapranadayaha. Manaschaikam. Manaschaikam. Buddhischaikaivam. Buddhischaikaivam. Saptadashakalabihi. Saptadashakalabihi. Saha. Saha. Yattishthati. Yattishthati. Tat sukshma shariram. Tat sukshma shariram. Shrotram twak. Shrotram twak. Chakshurasana. Chakshurasana. Ghranam. Ghranam. Iti panchajnanendriyani. Iti panchajnanendriyani. We're looking at the sukshma sharira. The sukshma sharira is the subtle body in contrast with the sthula sharira. We saw that the sthula sharira is a panchikrita panchamahabhutahi kritam sat karma janyam sukadukadibhoga ayatanam shariram asti jayati vardate viparinamate apakshiyate dinashati iti shat vikaravat etat stula shariram. So the gross body, meaning the physical tangible body, is made up of the panchamahabhutas, which have undergone the process of panchakaranam. So these are the five subtle elements which have become, some people say punchified, have become fivefold. And I want to talk a little bit about that because we're talking about panchikaranam quite a bit. And I think I've kind of left you in the dark here a bit. Later on in the text, the author will talk about the srishti prakriya. He will do a very thorough analysis of this creation process and go into great detail about how this panchikaranam process takes place. But just so you have a sense of it, there are five subtle elements. And this panchikaranam process, from a very simple perspective, is that the subtle elements bifurcate. The tamoguna portion of the subtle elements split in half. So we'll talk about what tamas is, sattva, rajas, and tamas. But right now, the inert aspects of the subtle elements split in half. And so you have two halves. And one of those halves itself splits into four parts. And the half of one of the subtle elements combines with one of those little portions that have split off. So, say, akasha is made up of the physical akasha. The akasha, which has undergone panchakaranam, is one half of the subtle element of Akasha and 1/8 of each of the other elements. And if this doesn't make sense, don't worry, because it'll become clear when he actually goes into it. But I want to sort of remove some of this mystery of what this Panchakaranam is. It's basically just that the subtle elements break in half, each of them. And then that one half, again, divides into quarters. And 1/4 of each of the remaining elements combine with the one big chunk half of the primary element. And in that combination, it manifests as the gross tangible element. So that's the process of Panchakaranam, which become more clear going forward. And there's a lot of dimensions to this srishti prakriya, to this creation prakriya. And we're touching on pieces of it because we're talking about the five Mahabhutas, we're talking about the Shabda Sparsha Rupa Rasa Gandha, and it'll all come together later in the text because we're seeing these 5-5-5 things. We're seeing 5 subtle elements, 5 tangible physical gross elements. We're seeing 5 senses. We're seeing 5 pranas. We're seeing 5 karmendriyani, the capacity for action. And now he's enumerating all of these, and they all are meant to be seen as one unified model, one cohesive unified model of the creation, which includes this individuality, this vyashti, this individual, this microcosm, within the context of this macrocosm, the samashti, this jiva within the context of Ishvara. It's all meant to wrap the entire creation up in a very cohesive and beautiful model. To what end? We're not studying physics here. We're not studying anatomy, right? We're not studying psychology, and yet we're touching on all of these. The tatparya, the intention of these models, these 3 bodies, these 5 koshas, these 3 states of experience, these 5 mahabhutas, this panchikaranam, all of this, is meant just to get a handle on anatma and to, in our vision, in our knowledge, resolve it into Bhagawan, into Ishvara, into the Lord. So seeing how this creation manifests from the Lord, we begin to appreciate that there's nothing here but the Lord. And that vision allows us to resolve all of this anatma, all of this stuff which I take myself to be, but we're in the process of prying ourselves away from. This model of the creation process allows us to put that somewhere in Bhagawan's creation. And what I mean by this is that the tatparya of all of this vichara into these, the physical body, the subtle body, the causal body, etc., is just to tap every door, just to knock on every door and say, do you take yourself to be the stula sharira? Well, let me tell you what the stula sharira is. Let me tell you what the gross body is. And by the way, it's inhabited by a sukshma sharira. And the qualities of the gross body are that it's made up of gross physical elements which undergo this process of panchikaranam. And that is its samanya karanam. Its general causes, its building materials are these 5 elements. And the specifics of this incarnation are a function of past karma palam that manifests or packaged in this prarabdha, in this set of experiences which we experience in this life. And that's what is the vishesha karanam. That's what accounts for the particularities of our experiences, which are sukha, dukkha, etc. So this body is a rental. This body is a temporary housing, the ayatana, through which we experience the sukha dukkhadi, the pleasurable and unpleasant experiences which are brought about by our karma palam. And the body has these particular aspects. It's asti, jayati, vartate, etc. And all of this is to help us understand really what this body is, what this physical body is, for the sake of understanding what I am not. So at each level, we're bringing this ahankara, we're bringing this I notion back a little bit. We're making it a bit more subtle each time. We're prying ourselves away from the most obvious mistakes. And we'll keep going on and on and on until the most subtle mistakes are resolved. And that creates the context for Tattvamasi. That creates the context for really understanding who I am. That is the 10th man counting out the other 9 boys before the stranger says, you are the 10th man. So Stula Sharira, 1. Sukshma Sharira, 2. Karna Sharira, 3, etc. This is the context that we're creating here. And so we're looking at the attributes of all of these bodies, of these koshas, of these avastha, of these experiences. And I just want to say, regarding the Stula Sharira, some people take the last phrase here. There's 4 phrases, right? There's the one which talked about the general cause, the specific cause, the purpose. And then the last one is asti jayate vartate, etc. Some people take asti jayate. Some people take jayate asti. Doesn't really matter. If you say asti jayate, asti usually refers then to the idea that one exists in the womb. So one exists in the mother's womb, and then jayate, one is born. And if you take it the other way, which we find in Niruktam, jayate, one is born, and then asti, one exists, and then one vartate, one grows, viparinamate, one changes over the course of the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years, apakshiyate, one starts, the body starts to decline, and vinashyati, one dies. And so anytime I point to myself and I say, I'm getting old. No, that oldness is a function of the physical body. That is not a function of you. You are the witness to that process of aging, the inevitable process. Everything in this world, every living being goes through this process. If I do not age and die, then where is mortality for me? If I am not this physical thing in this body, where spatially am I? Looking at this Shatvikaravat Shariram, this body which has these 6 modifications, solely for the purpose of understanding anatma. This is one way to look at one aspect of anatma, the Stula Sharira. It's not to understand biology or anatomy, right? So what is the Sukshma Sharira? We saw Sukshma Shariram Kim. It is the Apanchikrita Panchamahabhudahi Kritam Sat. It is those parts of my experience, those aspects of my experience, which I take myself to be, which are caused by the apanchikrita panchamahabhutas, whose material cause, whose substance is the subtle elements, which have not undergone this process of breaking in half and being combined with the other pieces. These are the subtle elements. This is the objects, if you will. And why do I say objects of the subtle world in my personal experience? And I say objects because I see objects. And these objects can be gross, and I need the pratyaksha, I need the senses to perceive gross, physical, tangible objects. I don't need the senses to perceive subtle objects. What are subtle objects? Subtle objects are the senses, the five jnanendriyas, the 5 karmendriyas, the 5 pranas, the manas, and the buddhi. So the subtle experience that we have, this inner life that we have, he's saying here, is a result of the five subtle elements which have not become manifest in this physical world as tangible objects. It's also born of karma janyam. It is also sukha-dukkha adi bhoga, but not ayatana. It's not the abode for the experience of sukha and dukkha. It is the means by which. Why do you say this subtle body is the means for experiencing sukha and dukkha? It's because you experience sukha and dukkha how? You have external pleasures and external pains, and you have internal pleasures and internal pains. And it's through the jnanendriyas, we experience the external sensations, which we then attribute to be either painful or pleasurable. And we, in the mind and in the buddhi, in the internal environment of our experience, we experience internal sukha and internal dukkha, suffering and pain and anxiety and remorse and guilt and pleasure, happiness, all the gamut of our experience. So that's why this is called the sadhana for sukha and dukkha, because without the sukshma sharira, we would have no means for experiencing the physical world, nor the internal world. So we saw that the subtle world, the subtle body, the sukshma sharira, is made up of the five elements and made up of the five sense capacities and the five karmendriyani and the five pranas and the mind and the buddhi, etc. So the next question is, what are the five jnanendriyas? And he just names them: Shrotram, Tvak, Chakshu, Rasana, Grahanam, Iti Pancha Jnanendriyani. And these are just the ear, the skin, the eye, the tongue, and the nose. Iti, put those in quote, iti, these are the five jnanendriyani. Now, these are not the physical senses. The physical senses are part of the physical world. These are the subtle capacities. If you have your eyeball plucked out, you will lose half your capacity to see. So the sukshma sharira is in keeping with the characteristics of the stula sharira. Like I said, if you have a monkey body, you're going to have a monkey mind, unless you're Hanuman, and then you're a great grammarian and a great bhakta. So what are the devatas here? The next thing he says are, what are the devatas? Let's go ahead and read this. Shrotrasya dik devata, Shrotrasya dik devata, Tvacho vayuhu, Tvacho vayuhu, Chakshushaha, Chakshushaha, Suryaha, Suryaha, Rasanayaha, Rasanayaha, Varunaha, Varunaha, Granasya Ashwanao, Granasya Ashwanao, Iti Jnanendriya Devataha, Iti Jnanendriya Devataha. This is a very comprehensive model, and there's different dimensions to it. And we have to look at what we mean by cause and effect here, because this is going to be important for understanding what the karana sharira is, what the next body that we're going to talk about, the causal body is. But it's also important for us to understand in this context too, because we see the Lord, we look at the Lord as the cause of this creation. And what do we mean by that? We mean that when we talk about this being the cause of the creation, do we look at it in something like a deist way, wherein this is a great machinery, that the clockwork that some god has created and released into the universe, and it's just clicking away on its own? Is it a god who creates a universe, sets up certain rules that people unfortunately easily break, and then punishes them for that? Is there a god that pokes his finger into the history for our salvation or demise? The vision that the Vedas give of Bhagawan, of Ishvara, is this: Abhinna Nimitta Upadana Karanam Ishvara. Ishvara is both the Upadana and Nimitta Karana Jagataha of the creation, which is Abhinna, which is not separate from the creation. Puja Swamiji is fond of saying that we don't believe in God. We believe only in God. There is nothing here but the Lord. Because if you ask a simple question, if you ask the question, what did God create all this out of? Right? Did he have a chunk of material in front of him that he then formed all this from? Then you'd have to ask, where did that chunk of material come from? And if it didn't come from Bhagawan, then we don't have a limitless God. There would be the existence of a Ishvara, plus the existence of something else. And that very existence of that something else other than Bhagavan would make Bhagavan limited. It would limit God. In fact, if I'm separate from God, then I limit God. That God is no longer limitless because he wouldn't include me. If he doesn't include me, if I'm not included in Bhagavan, then there's no concept of a limitless being. A limitless being needs to include everything. And the vision of the Vedas is that there is nothing here but Ishvara. And how can that be? There's this technical term, abhinna nimitta upadana karanam. Karanam means cause. Upadana karanam means a material cause. And nimitta karanam means an instrumental or efficient cause. And abhinna means non-separate, non-divided. Bid means to divide. Bhinna means divided. Abhinna means not divided. And there's several imageries given for this, several drishtantas to help us understand. One is a pot and a pot maker. So the material cause, the upadana karanam for a pot is clay. What's the relationship between the cause and the effect? The cause is clay, the effect is the pot. What's the relationship? The relationship between the cause and the effect is one of substance and name and form. It's one of satyam and mithya. This is the relationship between cause and effect. The upadana karanam, the cause of a gold bangle, is gold. The effect, in the way we're talking about this, is the bangle. The bangle is never away from gold. Gold is not transcendent to the bangle. When I see the bangle, really all I see is gold. So too Bhagavan. And that's why we talk about this prapancha or srishti prakriya. We'll, again, go into that in much more detail. But to see that all of this comes just from Bhagavan and there is no difference between the cause and the effect. Very much like there is no difference between the cause, clay, and the effect, the pot. And that's why we say abhinna upadana karanam. Ishvara is the non-separate cause of this entire creation. And there's a lot more that can be said about that, but and he is considered the nimitta karanam, the instrumental or efficient cause, and much like a pot maker. Because a pot maker is a conscious being who creates his creation. But the challenge with that example is that the pot maker is not the pot. The pot maker is not the clay. The pot and the clay are separate. So it's an imperfect example. One that the Upanishads talk about, the Mundaka Upanishad, mentions the Urnanabhihi. Yata urnanabhihi srijate grinhate cha. Just as a spider spins a web from its own body, and then srijate, it manifests, it creates this out of himself or herself, and then grinhate brings it back. So too, that's an imagery by which we can understand how Ishvara creates this creation from himself and resolves it back into himself as a conscious being. So in that sense, the spider is both the nimitta and upadana karanam. It's both the material cause, because this material comes from the spider. The material of the spider web comes from the spider, who is a creator, who is a conscious being, who does the creative process. So that's one example that's used. And a challenge with that example is that when the spider creates the spider web, that spider web is at that point separate from the spider. It will resolve back in to the spider. The idea is that the spider swallows the spider web back up and resolves it back into his or her own body. But that's a limitation of the drishtanta. But here we have a vision of Ishvara where the creator is no different than the creation. The cause is no different than the effect. And so one reason why this is so important is because he's starting to talk here about adhishtatra devatas, the presiding deities over different faculties of perception. That's what this section is about. Shrotrasya dig devata asti. The Shrotrasya dig devata. So for the ear, the devata is dig, is space or the directions. What does that term devata mean? So when we look at this, when we look at Ishvara, Bhagavan, from a given perspective of the creation, we can view that as a devata. And by this, the entire prapancha, the entire creation, can be seen to be more clearly a manifestation of the Lord. So, for example, we have a governor, right? We have a government. In this central government lies all power, total power in this machinery that we call the government. And this government is divided into different functions, into a state department. I guess in India, they're called ministries. In the United States, they're called departments. So you have a Department of State, Department of Treasury, Justice, Agriculture, Commerce, Labor, Defense, Energy, etc. And each of these functions represents a power. One aspect of the total government seen from a certain perspective, right? The Department of Justice, the Department of Agriculture, from the perspective of commerce, the power of the central government is manifest as a Department of Commerce. So we can see that the entire government is a unified power, much as Ishvara. And then we have the State Department, for example. And the State Department is governed by a set of rules, a set of laws. For example, perception. When we're looking at Ishvara, there's a set of laws which operate, which allow perception to happen. And therefore, we can have the discipline of ophthalmology. Because if sense perception, like sight, just functioned willy-nilly, we would never be able to remove a cataract or to correct any eyesight. But it operates by a set of laws, a universal set of laws. And this set of laws is governed in the government by the head of the department, by the Secretary of State, for example, who runs the State Department. The presiding minister, or this exalted jiva, is the devata for that set of laws. The conscious being, any power resides with a conscious being. And then we can see that the particular manifestation of the laws of the State Department as governed by the Secretary of State, that manifests in particular countries as diplomats. So the diplomats in a country gain their authority through the minister or the head of that of the State Department. And that minister or head of that State Department only gains his authority, his or her power, because of the appointment to be responsible for those particular laws. And those laws are really a subfunction of the total government. So you have the total government, you have laws pertaining to specific aspects of governing, you have the head of the department And then you have multiple diplomats. So too, you have Ishvara, who represents the totality of the laws, seen through certain functions. Here we're looking at them from a function of the Jnanendriyas, but we'll look at them from the Karmendriyas too, and the Manas and the Buddhi and all that. So the Lord seen from any particular aspect and from the Mahabhutas themselves. So we have Bhagawan as seen from a particular function can be understood as a conscious devata, as the head of state, for example, the minister of that particular function. And then our particular capacity to see is that specific manifestation of that devata. So one thing that this vision allows us to have is that if we have specific needs, we can go up the proper channel, right? If I had a problem in international relations, I wouldn't go to the Department of Commerce, or I wouldn't go to the Department of Agriculture. I'd go through my particular diplomat for that particular country. So too, if you have a problem with the eyes, you may invoke certain prayers for Surya, because we'll see that Surya is the devata for the eyes. Well, why would I just invoke for Surya? Because it's a focused approach. It's not a splatter approach to prayer. Some traditions have, say, this idea of saints. If you have, there's a saint of transportation, there's a saint of finding a parking spot, there's a saint of illness, there's a saint of specific illnesses. And so you pray to a saint in certain traditions to be sort of the intermediary, to intercede between you and God, because there's this notion of division between you and Bhagawan. Here, there is no separation. So really, the manifestation of my capacity to see through these physical eyeballs is governed by the laws which are personified and manifest as Ishvara, as the devata of that particular sense capacity. I hope this is making sense. So it's another way to see really that this vyashti, this microcosm, is really part and parcel of the samashti, of the macrocosm. That all the way from Bhagawan, if you have a sense of separateness there, all the way from Bhagawan down into our particular capacity to do something through the Karmendriyas, or perceive something through the Jnanendriyas, or think something, experience anything, there's a continuous, there's no discontinuity between Bhagawan and anything in my experience. So this Adhishtatra Devata is a succinct way of seeing a manifestation of Ishvara vis-a-vis a particular function. And another way we might be more familiar with is, say, Ganapati, Ganesha, right? Who's Ganesha? Ganesha is the remover of obstacles, right? So on one hand, you can say, now this is a little different because he's not really an Adhishtatra Devata, but the idea is similar, is that if you have obstacles to be removed before you start any project, before you do anything, before you drive your new car, you have obstacles, you go on a journey, you do a little puja to Ganapati or chant a little shloka, because that is Bhagawan seen as the karma pala data. Ganesha is the one who gives us our karma pala. And he is the one who can remove obstacles, but he's the one who put them there in the first place as the karma pala data. So we want to win certain favor, you know, special favor from him, because he can grease the skids. He can, you know, he can... We pray to him and for him to remove the obstacles and make our road smooth ahead. So that's a similar concept of approaching a particular amsha, a particular facet of the Lord, and focusing on that, also focusing the mind clearly, and for realizing that anything in our experience here is not separate from Bhagawan. Our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our hands, our feet, our mind, our thoughts. There's nothing here that's not Bhagawan. And this is just one little way to appreciate that. And so the law viewed as itself, right? So we saw that there's these laws, this orderly functioning of the universe. And this is the stuff of the universe. And so we can see the laws as the upadana karana, as the material cause. This is the way all of this functions. This is the orderliness. This is the order of the universe. The eyes function in a certain way. This can be seen as the upadana karanam. And then from a perspective of nimitta karanam, we see a devata, because a devata is a conscious being, just as Bhagawan is consciousness and this entire creation. So from a perspective of just the upadana karanam, the material cause, it's the laws are functioning. And the nimitta karanam, the one who presides over that particular function, that is the adhishtatra devata. Adhishtatra devata. Okay? So there is some correlation here between this srishti prakriya and the devatas. And some of them are very clear and some are a little less clear. Shrotrasya dig devata. The devata for hearing is direction or space. So hearing is born of space. And this will make more sense when we see how the Mahabhutas correlate with the Jnanendriyas and correlate with the objects of the Jnanendriyas. They all correlate in a certain way. And this is reflected in the devatas that are noted here. So Tvachaha Vayuhu, air, is a devata. Vayuhu is air. Now, it's not physical air. It's the devata of air. So even we look at this as air as a divine conscious manifestation that we experience for tvach, for touch. And chakshushaha, sight, is governed by surya. Rasanayaha varunaha, the devata. So you need to fill in the word devata and asti at the end of each of these. So the devata, rasanayaha varunaha, water is the devata for taste. Rasanayaha is trilinga, shashti, vibhakti, ekavachanam. It is a feminine genitive. All these are in genitive case, singular. Rasana. Rasana. There's a beautiful kriti, a bruhi mukundeti, which is bruhi se mukunda iti. O tongue, O rasane. So the vocative of rasana is rasane. Rasane means O tongue. Bruhi, say mukunda. Mukunda iti. Iti puts mukunda in quotes. Say the name of the Lord, O tongue. Bruhi mukunda iti rasane. It's a beautiful kriti. It's the same word here. Rasanayaha varunaha. Varunaha, rasanayaha devata. So Varuna is the devata for the tongue. Granasya Ashwana, the Ashwana Kumara, the twins, are the devata for smelling. Maybe because of the two nostrils, I'm not really sure. Let's go on to the next sentence. Shrotrasya Vishayaha, Shrotrasya Vishayaha, Shabda Grahanam. Shabda grahanam tvacho vishayaha sparsha grahanam chakshusho vishayaha rupa grahanam rasanaya vishayaha rasagrahanam Ghranasya Vishayaha, Gandagrahanamiti. So we can move sort of quickly over this. This is something of a known known quantity here. So Shrotrasya Vishayaha Shabdagrahanam. So he's telling us the functions of each of the senses here. Vishayaha means an object, or it means here a domain, a field, a sphere. So the vishayaha of the shrotrasya, of the ear, is shabdagrahanam. Grah means to grasp. Grahanam means grasping, cognition. Of what? Of shabda. So the domain of the sense of hearing is the cognition of sound. Tvacho vishayaha sparsha grahanam. The domain of touch of the skin is sparsha grahanam, is the cognition of sparsha, of the sensation of touch. Chakshushaha vishayaha, the domain of the eye, is rupa grahana, is the cognition or the grasping of rupa. Here, rupa means both form and color. Rasanayaha vishayaha, rasagrahanam. So of the tongue, the domain, the vishaya, is the grasping of taste. And grahanasya vishayaha, the domain of the sense of smell, is gandha grahanam, is the grasping or cognition of fragrance or odor. And notice that really all we perceive are these things, are shabda, sparsha, rupa, rasa, gandha. And these are characteristics of these gross physical mahabhutas. It all comes together, in a sense, when we look at the srishti prakriya later on. But we're really not seeing a thing. Just because we perceive a sound or a fragrance or touch, we cannot necessarily conclude that that's a real thing. The domain of the capacity to touch are those things that are touchable. But because something is touchable, it doesn't mean that it's sat. It's mithya, actually. Just because something is perceivable with our senses, it has a name and a form and our eyes can see it. It has a form and color and our eyes can see it, doesn't mean it's real, doesn't mean it's sat. Because we can taste it or smell it or feel it. You know, if we can feel something, oh, this is a hard, you know, we knock on a piece of concrete or a brick. This must be real because it's solid. That doesn't make it real. That just makes it appears real because it's tangible. And we somehow conclude that because if something is tangible, it's real. But it didn't exist before and it won't exist later. It's not real. It's decomposable into its constituent parts. It's not inherently real. It's sat asadbhyam anirvachaniyam. You can't say that anything that is perceived in through any of these senses, anything that possesses the shabda sparsha rupa rasa gandha, is real, and you can't say it's not real because it's perceived. It's mithya. Just because something is perceived does not make it satya. So let's go on to this next sentence. Vak pani pada, vak pani pada, payupasthaniti, payupasthaniti, panchakarmendriyani, panchakarmendriyani, vacho devata vanhihi, vacho devata vanhihi, hastayorindraha, hastayorindraha, padayor vishnuhu, padayor vishnuhu, payor mrityuhu, payor mrityuhu, upastasya prajapatihi, upastasya prajapatihi, iti karmendriya devataha, iti karmendriya devataha. Now we're moving on to the karmendriyas. And again, we're going through this fairly quickly. Some of this is pretty straightforward. So what are the karmendriyas? What are the capacities for action? They are vak, pani, pada, vayu, upastha, iti, panchakarmendriyani. Their vak is the capacity for speech. Now, the jnanendriyas, the sense capacities, are input mechanisms. These karmendriyanis are, in a sense, output mechanisms. They're ways in which we contribute, we participate, we interact with the world. And interestingly, I'll give a little more preview of this srishti prakriya. Each of these subtle elements, mahabhutas, have a sattva aspect, a rajas aspect, and a tamas aspect. So we haven't talked much about that. We'll talk more about it later. But sattva, these gunas are presented in different ways. These are three either qualities or aspects. They're presented, say, in the Bhagavad Gita. Sri Krishna talks about the sattva, rajas, or tamas versions of different activities. So the word sattva refers to intelligence or the ability to reflect consciousness or a purity. Rajas refers to those things which are active, and tamas refers to those things that are inert or dull. So this model of the gunas accounts for this creation and also for one's own character and actions. So for example, Krishna talks about what does it mean to give charity? What does it mean to do tapas, to do spiritual disciplines? And he divides each of these into three. He says, if you're predominantly sattva, your dhanam, your giving, your charity will be well-timed. It will be given without any expectation of results, of reciprocation, and it will be given to the right person at the right time for the right reason. And that reflects a certain purity of spirit, purity of mind, purity of heart. And then there's the rajasika, one who is predominantly rajas, may give, but he'll give with the expectation of, okay, you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. It's a little more needy. It's a little more aggressive. It's a little more desire-bound. And then he'll say, well, someone who's predominantly tamas, who's basically confused and dull and one of very questionable character, will give to the wrong thing at the wrong time to the wrong person for the wrong reason. So this idea of the gunas is a model that helps us understand qualities of an individual which are changeable. So the words sattva, rajas, and tamas, those are nouns. The adjectival form are sattvika, rajasika, and tamasika. So if we see tamasika qualities in ourselves, we can work to transform those. And we may need to work to transform those into rajasika qualities so that eventually we can become sattva guna pradhanaha. We can become predominantly equanimous, giving, saintly, right? That's a part of the psychology of the Gita. A big portion of the psychology of the Gita is the transformation of an individual's character, heart and mind, moving up from tamas to rajas to sattva. So this is one way that the, and he talks about this, you know, there's rajas and tamas and sattva food and giving and spiritual disciplines and all sorts of ideas. In fact, Puja Swamiji at the end of the last course suggested that people extract those verses, those shlokas that refer to the sattva gunas and consolidate them and chant those every day. Right, because some of us would chant back in the day, amanitvam adam bhitvam himsakshantararchavam, those qualities every morning, just to remind ourselves, well, this is our goal. If I see an incongruity between these values that I have and my actions, then I need to pay attention to that. And as per today's meditation, I don't need to judge myself by those, right? If there's an incongruity between my value and my manifestation of how I live in this life, my actions or my thoughts, then that is to be noticed, just like you notice the breath when you're meditating on just the sensation of the breath and your mind wanders. What do? You say, oh, I'm such a bad person. I'm supposed to be focusing on the breath, and I'm not focusing on the breath. I just can't meditate. I just have such an agitated mind. No, you don't do that. You might do that. What you want to do is say, ah, the mind wandered. And without judgment, without remorse, without condemnation, you just bring it back to your object of meditation, right? So if you notice an incongruity between your value and your action, or your value and your thoughts, or your value and your speech, the hardest thing to do is that noticing. And then you can choose to align them. Then you can choose to align your action with those values. And so reminding yourself in the morning of what those sattva guna aspects are, it's a very beautiful sadhana, because it every morning you say, this is my intention. This is how I intend to live my life. I intend to live my day expressing these values and noticing in a non-judgmental way if I don't, forgiving myself if I need to, and realigning myself to those values. That's by the way. So you can look at these sattva, rajas, and tamas as characteristics of an individual, which are changeable. They're also presented as the material cause of this creation. So maya, which is the material cause for this creation and part and parcel of Bhagavan, of Ishvara, is trigunatmika, has these three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. And so in this srishti prakriya, in this method of analysis, this prakriya of the srishti, of the creation, we also take into account these three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. So in the model that Krishna talks about character building in creating a saintly, contemplative, thoughtful disposition in your mind, sattva is responsible for those good qualities, for contemplativeness, for thoughtfulness, for love, for spontaneous dharma. Sattva is responsible for those, for charity, for selfless works. Rajas in one's character is responsible for activity, positive or negative, hyperactivity, overagitation, excessive greed, excessive raga, excessive dvesha. And tamas is responsible for mental dullness, for just confusion, for complete adharma, for not seeing the forest for the trees, just having no clue as to how to live one's life, either a dullness, a slothfulness, or even adharma. In the creation model, sattva is seen to be responsible for clarity, for intelligence, and for the capacity for reflecting consciousness. Rajas is activity, and tamas is inertness. And it's not like you want to transform the inertness of a table into the activity of an animal. You don't want your table running around even though it has four legs. You want your table with four legs just to stay as it is. So it's okay that that's tamas, right? You don't need to try to transform tamas in the register or sattva. But as I mentioned before, the panchikaranam takes the tamas aspects of each of the mahabhutas, of each of the subtle elements, and works with those. And because they're inert, tamas is inert, and you undergo this process of panchikaranam, that's how you get the inert creation. Now, what about sattva and rajas? Rajas means activity. So when you take the rajas aspect of these mahabhutas, of these subtle elements, those create the karmendriyas. Those are responsible for the specific karmendriyas, because what do we do with the karmendriyas? Karma indriyas, the capacity for action. What's responsible for action? Rajas. Rajas is a general quality that accounts for activity in this world and transformation. And then what about the sattva aspects? So each of these tanmatras, each of these mahabhutas, each of these elements is threefold: tamas, rajas, and sattva. So we talked about tamas, we talked about rajas, and now sattva. So sattva is responsible for sentiency. So it's said, and again, we'll talk about this in more detail, that the jnanendriyas, the sense capacities, are made of the sattva aspects of these subtle elements, as is the entire antakarana, the entire mind. So this is just an introduction, and if that didn't make sense or it's too confusing, too many moving parts, that's okay. We'll see all this in detail further on down the road here. But I want to give you a sense that now that we're talking about karmendriyas, that we're actually talking about the rajas aspect of the subtle body and the rajas aspect of the mahabhutas, the subtle elements. And this subtle body is made of these subtle elements. And why are we studying this? Why do I care about enumerating the five senses, the five inputs, and the five outputs? Because I am not those. So any notion that I have about myself as being any of these needs to be reconsidered. So Vak is the capacity for speech. And there could be a lot to be said about that, but I think I'm running out of time here. Vak is the capacity for speech. It's the organ of speech. Well, manifest it through the organ of speech or communication. Pani does not mean water here. It does not mean water. It means the hand. It means the, not the physical hand, because again, we're talking about the subtle aspect. So it's the capacity for grasping physically. Legs, pada are the feet or the legs. The payuhu are the organs of evacuation or excretion. And upastha is the organs or the genitals or the organs of procreation. And they all have their devatas too. So we already read this. The vachaha devata is vanhihi. The hasta devata, the hasta yoho, because it's dual, hasta yoho devata is Indra. Pada yoho Vishnuhu. Payoho is Mrityuhu. Upastasya is Prajapatihi. And these are the karmendriya devataha. So let's look at those individually. Vanhi is fire, and that's related to speech. That's the devata. Vanhi is the devata for speech. Why is that? Well, some people say when one talks, the mouth gets dry. Heat is generated during speech. Some people say, no, that's not it. Light reveals. Speech should reveal. Speech, shabda, pramana. Shabda is a means of knowledge. Shabda is a means of knowledge. Fire is prakashatmaka. It is of the nature of illumining. Speech should illumine its subject, its topic. So that's one way you can look at why fire is the devata of speech. Indra, hands, because they're powerful. Imagine, Indra can be seen as one of the most powerful devatas. And hands are the most capable organs. Imagine us without hands. If we didn't have opposing thumbs, we would still be probably crawling. Or it doesn't go the other way around. Because we're not crawling, we have opposing thumbs. I don't know. Vishnuhu is the devata of legs or of movement. And you can see, well, you know, Vishnu took an avatar as Vamana. Do you remember the Puranic story of Vamana? He was incarnated as a little person who took huge strides. So the story is that Vishnu was addressing Mahabali. Mahabali said, I will grant you as much land as you can cover in three steps. And so in the first step, this little short person covers from earth to heaven. And in the second step, the rest of the earth, or some versions say the earth to the nether worlds. So he's covered all of creation with just two steps. And what's left? The third step. Mahabali, he puts his head down and offers it, and the Lord steps on his head and takes him as well. What a blessing to be taken by the Lord. So Vishnu in this avatar can be seen as one who has great strides and then therefore can be the devata of legs. Also, Vishnu comes from Vish, to pervade. So one who is all pervasive. One way you can look at this story is that Vishnu is all pervasive. He pervades from earth up and from earth down and even you. Vishnu, the one who's all pervasive. Mrityu, payu. So Mrityuhu is a devata of payu, of waste disposal. And so death does the same thing. Imagine a world where there was no waste disposal. You can kind of see this in hoarders. A hoarder is one who only has input and no output mechanism. A hoarder is one who keeps accumulating things and never lets it go, either physically or, you know, there's emotional hoarders too, who just take on things and just never let things go. But in the physical world, mrityu is a disposal mechanism, as are our bodily mechanisms of disposing of waste. We want to get rid of things. What if the dead bodies didn't compose? Or what if death never came and we were 1,008 years old? I can't imagine trying to walk down the walk down the block. Prajapati is the devata of upastha, of procreation. So Prajapati is Brahmaji. And just to clarify, some people have some problems with just this word. So the word is Brahman, and a Brahman can be neuter or masculine. As neuter, nominative singular, it is Brahma, Brahma. So in the neuter, as in aham brahmasmi, aham, I, Brahma, asmi, I am Brahma, that is parabrahma, that is nirguna Brahma, that is Atma, that is the Satchit Ananda Swarupa Atma, that is the truth of this creation. As a masculine noun, Brahman is declined as Brahma, just like Atman is declined as Atma. The word is Atman. We usually cite words in the nominative singular. The masculine nominative singular of Atman is Atma. So too, the masculine nominative singular is Brahman is Brahma. And when it's masculine, it refers to Brahmaji. So we often put G at the end because G is a respectful suffix of veneration and respect, and it means a person. You're not going to put G when you're referring to an inanimate object. So oftentimes we'll say Brahmaji. There should be a long A, but Brahma is Parabrahma, which is Atma, just to clarify. So this is Prajapatihi. Is Brahmaji, and he is the devata for the procreative capacities. And let's quickly just finish this section up here of regarding these karmendriyas. Vacho vishayo bhashanam, vacho vishayo bhashanam, panyor vishayo vastugrahanam, Panyor Vishayo Vastugrahanam, Padayor Vishayo Gamanam, Padayor Vishayo Gamanam, Payor Vishayo Malatyagaha, Payor Vishayo Malatyagaha, Upastasya Vishaya Ananda Iti, Upastasya Vishaya Ananda Iti. So these are talking about the vishayas, the domains of each of these karmendriyas. So we can go through this fairly quickly here. The vachaha vishaya, the domain of speech, is bhashanam, is speech. The domain of the capacity for speech is bhashanam, is language, is speech. The domain, vishaya, for panyoho, for the hands, is vastugrahanam, is the capacity for grasping things. Vastu means an object, and grahanam literally means grasping. So the domain for the hands is grasping things, manipulating things with your hands. Padayor vishayaha gamanam, the domain for the feet or the legs is transportation, is going. Gamanam literally means going, walking. Payor vishayaha malatyagaha. So the domain for the organ of excretion is malatyaga. Tyaga is getting rid of mala, getting rid of things you want to get rid of, mala. We have to pay attention when you study Sanskrit because the difference between mala and mala is a world of difference. You don't want malatyaga. Mala is a garland of flowers. You don't necessarily want to get rid of your garlands of flowers, but you do want to get rid of your mala, the dirt. And lastly, Upastasya vishayaha ananda iti. So ananda, joy, is a domain of procreation because, you know, it's a pleasurable experience. And who doesn't look at a little newborn baby and feel joy? It's a natural, it's probably an evolutionary adaptive mechanism to have these sensations of happiness when you see the innocence of a newborn, even if it's not your species, right? A cat, a puppy, a kitten. A newborn. There's joy even just in the perception of that if it's not yours. And then if it is yours, you have the joy of the continuation, the perpetuation of your lineage, of your family. You've created a family. There's a lot of joy inherent in that. So ananda is a domain for procreation there. He does not mention pranas here specifically. So next week we will pick up what the pranas are and then go into the karana sharira. What do we mean by a causal body? That's one of the more esoteric aspects of this teaching here, of this model, and we'll explore that next week. Let's take a moment to sit quietly. Swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahishaha go brahmanebhyah shivamastu nityam lokah samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshati parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yankshu barahitah brahmana santu nirbhayah om sarve bhavantu sukhinah sarve santu niramayah sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kashchit dukkha bhag bhavet asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityor ma amrtangamaya om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om Sarvamishwararpanamastu. So this is all very sort of technical information that we can kind of go quickly through. It is beautiful and interesting. And if we understand it in the context that it's meant, in terms of appreciating the difference between Atma and Anatma, then it becomes alive. And the Devata is appreciating that they are specific perspectives on Bhagawan, who is the cause of this entire creation. That is also a very beautiful vision as well. But some of the details are pretty self-evident.
Yeah, I was thinking that this entire teaching is something which sort of tells you how deluded your experience is. We keep on experiencing our bodies and minds, senses, and we keep on believing that we are upset because of something which happened to me and something that I did do or did not do. And so in other words, we are always concentrating on the anatma.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And that's why, like, for example, if you have anxiety, sometimes personally I find that labeling internal phenomenon is very useful because it just helps see patterns. Swamiji, during my course, would talk about seeing a lot of the dysfunctional emotional patterns that we have as habitual tapes. Now, back in that day, we didn't have MP3s, we had tapes that would loop around. But if you can identify and see the reoccurrence of certain emotional patterns, that helps put a little thumb hold, a little distance between you and that pattern. For example, if you have anxiety, you know, if you have like mini anxiety attacks, or go, oh no. And then if you can just see it and go, oh, that's familiar. I don't really need to tend to that because there's nothing there about which I should be anxious. Sometimes it dissipates on its own. Sometimes it has a life of its own, and anxiety or sadness or whatever will go in its own time. But I find if I can label some of these phenomena, especially when we're so concerned about, you know, that there's such an identity with, and say, oh, this is familiar. It feels rotten. But look at this phenomenon. Look at this. Look at this. Look at this. And then after a while, you can measure your responsiveness, the depth of your identification with some of these things. In other words, we can see our identification with our bodies and our minds and our notions of how things should be through our reactiveness to the world around us, right? And our reactiveness can be measured in terms of three dimensions, three parameters in terms of frequency of reaction, intensity of reaction and duration of reaction. So because I take myself to be a wanting person, I place my happiness on external situations, and therefore I take the anatma as atma, and therefore I'm very vulnerable in this world, and I have reactions to the world. And I see as I grow in vairagya, in objectivity, and in maturity, that reactiveness to the world diminishes in frequency and duration and intensity. We've had endless lifetimes of taking ourselves to be the anatma. And that's why repeated vichara is necessary. And that's why satsang is so useful. Because when you're out there in the world, everybody takes themselves to be this limited being, and everybody's struggling for these limited resources to prop themselves up. And satsang is such a relief, just hanging out with like-minded people, because, okay, so we're not under the same delusion. We take ourselves, hopefully, a little less seriously. Our needs are not quite as aggressively imposing themselves on us. We have a bit of perspective on life, and having satsang helps increase that day after day. And so does repeated shravanam.
Yeah, I think that's one reason why I like to keep on listening to the talks that you put out, because a lot of times you don't get something at the first time. And when you listen to it again and reflect on it, I think then you say, yes, there is something that I have to think about, and that makes it much more interesting. It's not enough to listen to a talk just once, or for that matter, recite a verse once in a way, or once and then forget about it. I think Shravana is, and Manana is, both are so important. I think probably Nididhyasana will come much later, I suppose. I don't know.
There's a continuum along that line between Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana, because the latter parts depend on the previous. So Manana depends on Shravana, and Nididhyasana depends on the previous too. And that's a common experience for all of us. We'll listen to Pooja Swamiji's talks and, I understand that. And then you come back a day, a week, a year later, a decade later, you go, wow, did I really understand that? I don't think so. I think I understand it now. And it's a continuing deepening and a continuing owning up of what's being said, because you have this, you can have this notion during Shravanam, you see what's being said, and yet the depth of that and the pervasiveness and the capacity to own up what's being said, and to really see that what's being said pertains to me and my experience, all that deepens over time. Shravana engenders, nurtures qualities that are needed for understanding. And so they support each other. That's why Pooja Swamiji will teach anybody. Traditionally, many people would not teach just the common man. You know, you'd have to go to a guru, you'd have to serve the guru, you'd have to become a renunciate, you'd have to wait your time, you'd have to do so much tapas, you'd have to do all these things before you even had the opportunity to study. But Swamiji sees that the actual Shravana itself helps create those qualities that are needed for understanding, and those qualities that are needed for understanding deepen the Shravanam. So they're mutually beneficial.
So we can be encouraged about the transformation part as well, because that, you know, from the rajas to the...
Yeah. It takes attention, though. That's why you make a sankalpa, you know, in your puja in the morning, or however you do it, or that's why we do those verses. It takes attentiveness, because you have to choose to transform. And you have that value for transforming, because you want to see this more clearly, and you see how dysfunctional anything other than having these sattva qualities about you is. So it doesn't necessarily just come on its own due to Shravanam. For some people it does. It's just amazing. I'm sure for Pooja Swamiji, I'm sure Pooja Swamiji is born with so many of these qualities already. So he's not a good example, but there definitely is. Shravana does transform your absolutely and your experience. And certainly choosing to live your life a certain way and have certain attitudes is
are we born with these three sattva, rajas and tamas qualities, are they developed during the childhood years or the environment?
You know, the nurture versus nature question is that answerable? My perspective is that it is both. If someone can be born with an inherent genius and aptitude for, say, music or mathematics, you have to say that some qualities of one's character or one's intelligence is inborn, is natural, is comes with this birth. You can also say that environment is a product of karma palam, so it also comes with this birth. It's just that some seem to be spontaneously expressed and some seem to be shaped as a young child. But if you have certain experiences when you're growing up that cause you to be a very agitated, violent person, perhaps you were born with those tendencies, perhaps they were nurtured in you. Any way you look at it, the hope is, and the understanding is that as you pay attention and choose to change, there's always opportunity to transform those tamas or rajas into more sattva expressions.
There's lots of hope.
Yeah, hope and attention. I think attention, you know, non-judgmental attention goes a long way. I think one problem we have is that we have great value for becoming saintly. We have a great value for becoming sadhus, you know, especially if we hang out with Pooja Swamiji, we see what a beautiful being he is, and we want to be with him. And then we take a stick and we beat ourselves up because we're not the saints we want to be, right? Yeah. And it doesn't quite work that way. And that's why, like in today's meditation, it's like you can...
Yes, today's meditation.
I need to fully accept that this manifestation is never going to be perfect, and yet choose to redirect my attention again and again and again to grow emotionally and to be as compassionate towards the world and myself as much as possible. And that actually extricates us from the samsaritvam, right? If I beat myself up because I'm not the saint I want to be, then that's just an expression of avidya. If I accept that the qualities, if I accept and then do what needs to be done to transform those qualities which I don't want to have in myself, then that's a vairagya towards my own inner experience. And that's an expression of knowledge.
Thank you very much, Dakshaji. This was a beautiful, beautiful talk. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Om.
Thank you.
Thank you.